accession number 22065, Reel 2.
Excuse me, Dennis Avey, Reel 2, do you think you had an advantage with your farm background that you've described, you know, with all this training?
Oh, absolutely.
The weapons and the route marches.
Oh, absolutely, because what brought me to favour with the regulars was particularly on the ranges. I got, I hate to say this, but I was getting possibles at every range like we were put to. And this was rather an unheard of thing. But the thing being that I was au fait with guns and all my life. I mean, I've been shooting ever since of 8 years of age. That was the 410, the top one. See the stock there that was cut off when I was 8 years of age. That was the gun I used. And I used to be a very good shot as well, as opposed to, as my dear father was, fantastic shot, and my grandfather, who was the wing gun to King George V. He was a great shot. He wasn't allowed to shoot, though. The thing is, they used to be up on the lead, you know, swinging birds in. This was it. And of course it was, and they used to say, have you done this before? I said, no, I don't know. I thought that was the best way to work it, you know, instead of saying, well, yes, I can do it. And of course I used to get a lot of old sweats coming up. By Jove, that was damn good, you know. And it was like falling off a log to me, you know, and that probably put me into prominence, and I got I was a star man in a few weeks, and I dropped into it as though I'd been all my life. I was athletic, I was very, very fit, but the training that we had was incredible, and of course it was then you and you, for special training. I went to special training. And then, to cut a long story short,
what was the special training?
Well, a more precise field work than anything else.
That would be the sort of marching and
trenches. Oh no, field craft.
And, yes,
the ability to be able to work across a country and to be unidentified, that sort of thing, camouflage and what have you. It was all in, and map reading. I used to love map reading, and it was, I could put my, I could go to map references like nobody's business. It was innate, if you like. It was old hat to me.
What were the old regulars like? You know, it must have been quite a shock for you.
They tried to trip me up left, right and centre, you know. It was amazing. And I always remember the food. It used to be eight on a table, and they used to bring this big tin with food on. And, of course, they used to tell the most terrible, filthy tales about to put you off your food. And that was the trick to do this, you know. But to me, all the food I could get was only good enough, you know, because of the tremendous exercise I was doing. And I suppose I developed that sort of attitude with them that was, I managed to equate the situation, you know, because they get very biased, you know, regulars those days. They were very biased about young chaps coming in from civil life, so to speak, you know. Very much biased those days. But the better you were, I think the more they seemed to respect you. But you had to be pretty good. I remember particularly they try to do things on me as well as other people in bayonet training. We used to have rifles with spring-loaded bayonets. You've got a bit of padding on you, but the great thing, they used to try and put the bayonet in, and it used to spring back, obviously, but get it right against the stop and then go straight in. And of course, those sort of tricks you had to be up to. But I did pretty well. I came out of it pretty well. But it was good. You had to use your nut as well with these chaps, although they were first-class blokes. I mean, they hadn't been in the army for a few months. They'd been in a lot of years, and they came from abroad as well. And, of course, those days they brought the old Urdu language back, and, of course, you used to pick up these Urdu words. It was remarkable how integrated that became in your conversation, you know. It's one of those things.
I suppose you would have been training mainly during the period of the so-called phony war, is that right?
Well, yes. And subsequent to that, we then... I got training on vehicles as well, brain carriers. And again, I was pretty au fait with the engineering on those. And I fell into that like nobody's business. But then Dunkirk came about. And a section of us was taken out, selected, and we went right down to on the south coast. We were going to do an action to Calais, around Calais. And we waited on the south coast there for 3 days. And then finally they said, well, we can't do anything, you'll have to go back. And I went straight from there to Liverpool with two platoons of men, and then went straight from Liverpool to the Middle East, right away.
So that was your first posting, really, was it?
Absolutely,
to the Middle East, yeah. Having, you know, the Calais one being abroad.
And I was abroad, I was on the desert in round about September 1940.
That was very early, wasn't it, in the desert campaigns.
Yeah. Mm.
Before you tell me about that, Dennis, what do you remember about Dunkirk?
Well, Dunkirk was a terrifying situation. And when we came back from the station that I said we were waiting 2 or 3 days to go over to do a certain action there to help them, we came back to, on Salisbury Plain somewhere. Anyway, there was a big camp set up for all these chaps coming back. And I was a guard commander then, and I had to do a guard on this area. And I always remember these poor chaps that I can't describe it. I've never seen such a bedraggled army in my life. And in the area in which they came back to, they'd left rifles and pistols and all over the shop. You know, they were that absolutely whacked straight up. They were in a terrible situation. And I posted a guard. I did one posting with God on, and then I took a look around the place myself, and it was dusk. You'll have to forgive me for this. And I was a corporal those days, and I was going, walking through, and one chappie I couldn't see at all. And he said, where's the bog, mate? Where's the bog, mate? And I to corporal. And I said, well, look, I'll take you over there, because it was only a question of seats, that was it, along about four in a row, you see. And I didn't realise it was one of my greatest friends. And we sat on this bog together and we talked, and I gave him what I had, my socks and underwear and stuff, and he was delighted, and he's alive to this day. Just about, Roy Emerson, and he was delighted, you know, and I was so pleased. He later became a commission rank, and he was on the desert doing, in charge of tank recovery. And that was it. He, great friend of mine. Great friend of mine.
Did you pick up the sort of and the feelings, the morale at that time?
Oh, absolutely. They didn't want to know. They were dejected entirely. Dejected, to say the very least. I've never seen such low morale in my life at that time. But there it is. I was reminded those days, I must admit, I forget who said this, but it's lions led by donkeys. I forget who said that. I think it was a German, I don't know. He admired the British spirit, but that was it.
So you were going to the Middle East. What you were saying, how far away places were. Did you, you know, when you got to Liverpool, did you realise you were going to the Middle East, or, you know, was it just
no,
due
well,
to be
well, it was a quick job. Two platoons were sent up there, and it was a quick job. We went through the motions virtually when we got to Liverpool, you know, as one does, you know. You have your proper parades and what have you. We were only there for a very short time, and then we left from Liverpool.
Well, and what did you leave on? How did you travel?
I remember the boat, oddly enough, the Otranto. The Otranto. It was a P&O boat, I believe, and that was quite an experience. But there it was.
What was your sort of accommodation like, and how crowded was it?
Let me see. I must admit I felt lucky, because in Liverpool there's a fellow from the Rifle Brigade, London Rifles, I think. And he was a Liverpool man, oddly enough. And he was the sergeant. And we became friends. And he was an old hand. He was an old regular. God sa Duncan. And we got on this boat. And, of course, the usual thing, you know. And the usual thing of parades and lifeboat drill and what have you. And he said, no, we're not having anything like that. He said, you pick four other men. He said, and you come with me. And what we did, we cleaned all the lavatories and the toilets. And we, as a result of that, that may seem pretty dreadful. But I didn't mind this. I was all for it. We got absolute fantastic food. Fantastic food. We used to be cheek by jowl with the galley, you see. And they used to look on us as, you know, one of them. And we used to get marvellous food. No praise, no nothing. And that was fantastic. And we used to have the life of Riley. So it just shows you the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. When you're young, invariably, you go there, 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 to get to there. And now, sometimes you get the reasoning that the shortest distance between two points is the straight line.
What was that journey like, though, apart from your Pardon? Wonderful food? What was the journey like? You know, was there any danger?
Oh, absolutely.
Were you in convoy?
Oh, absolutely, yes. The mine cutters used to go out practically every day. And there was always warnings, you know, of shubs and all those what.
Did you have any attacks?
Pardon?
Were there any attacks?
No, fortunately not. There were one or two warnings, everyone on the alert and what have you. Well, not one or two, there was more than that. But we never got an actual attack. And that was it. And we finally got to Africa. Port Tewfik, I think it was. Port Tewfik, yeah. And we came up to... Oh, God, forget the base. There was a base camp by the Bitter Lakes. And I always remember the Bitter Lakes very, very well because that was our only method of really bathing, of cleaning ourselves, and to get into the Bitter Lakes and swim, and that was it. And there was... The salt was so dense. It was like the Dead Sea. It was virtually like the Dead, not as dense as, but it was like swimming in oil, you know, and that was it. And I always remember one time we came back, we drove back with a PU, and we came across the sweet, what they used to call the Sweetwater Canal. And it was only a temporary bridge, a wooden bridge, that's all. The Sweetwater Canal was only about 10, 15 foot wide, that was all. And I noticed a kid on this water buffalo's back, in this, and it slid off it and was in the water. I stopped the PU, went in after the kid and dumped her on the side, and that was it. And apparently one of our chaps told somebody or other about it. And they sent for me, and I got a series of no end of injections. They apparently, the intensity of bacteria in there was extraordinary. And I had about five or six different injections for different things. And I had an arm like nobody's business for weeks and weeks. And I had a dreadful time. Anyhow, I finally went up on the desert. And that was it. And it was quite an experience.
I suppose you were having more training, were you, at the Bitter Lakes?
Oh, yes. We were trained and trained for the desert without any doubt at all.
What sort of training did you have? Do you remember, Dennis? The desert.
Not a lot of basic training. It was mostly marches, route marches and things like that. And I suppose they wanted to kill or cure, you know, that sort of thing. But not a lot of training. Not a lot of training as such.
Were they getting you used to desert conditions?
Well, I suppose it was, but then these stupid guards that we used to have to mount as well. And I always remember that was my first run-in with another brigade, the KRRs, because I remember coming once back from a guard, and I had about 12 men with me on the guard. March them back, and of course the procedure is you're inspected and your arms are inspected and what have you by an officer and a sergeant major. And we march them in and right away, okay. And then port arms for inspection, and you pull your bolts back, and then you bring it forward to look down the barrels and what have you. Everything is inspected. And I ran into trouble because when they said port arms, I didn't respond at all. And they did this three times, recover, port on, I didn't recover. Then they went through the motions, you know, and they asked me to stay back on prayer after the... the officer and sergeant major came to me, why didn't you port on? I said, in our regiment, I said, NCOs are above, not above this sort of thing, but are respected, and it's their obligation to be clean without having to inspect arms. And that was it. But nonetheless, they made me port arms on my own, and of course my rifle was spotless without any doubt. But that was the situation. NCOs were never allowed their arms to be inspected because it was always on their shoulders that they should be. Anyhow, I finally got back up the desert, and...
Yes, what was happening? What was the war situation when you were first involved in it? What was happening
in the
desert?
Well, the Italians were in the war. They were coming down progressively down to... they were coming down through Libya. Then they broke through the wire and they got to Siloam. And then they finally got to Bugbug, I think. Bugbug. And it was said that Mussolini had installed trams and what have you at Bugbug. Well, when I got there, I had the shock of my life. There were a few shacks and that was it. That was Bugbug. It was, it was incredible. And... anyhow, when we started the push with Wavell, we pushed up and had a series of actions up and down there. The Italians they weren't the pushover people used to think, you know. More particularly, their artillery. Their artillery was absolutely first class. First class. And I had an experience of that.
Yes, could you explain that, your experience?
An experience that if you ever radioed anywhere, because those days we used very basic radio, you were picked up immediately, and the DFs, the directional finders, were straight on you, and immediately. And more particularly outside areas, like Tobruk and Siloam and what have you. And they used to build what they used to call sangars. And they were stone enclosures on the desert. And they used to have outer small sangars as their security. And from that, they used to build rocks miles out on the desert as aiming posts as well. So they knew direction, they knew exactly the distances and what have you. And as soon as they got the messages immediately, there used to be a salvo come over if you were anywhere near there. But quite apart from that, I experienced them in one of the areas, I forget where it was, where our tanks went on open sights and the Italian guns were on open sights against our tanks. And they fought to the last man, the artillery. And oddly enough, I was only twice ever asked to do an inventory. And I did an inventory on a section of those guns. It was the day after. And, of course, there was a lot of dead about from what have you. And I made this inventory, and then I got walking along behind the guns. I noticed one chappie with his arms out like that. He's lying down and his fingers out like that. And I could see the lines in the sand that his fingers made. And then I caught sight in the sun, I caught sight of a glint, and it was a leather. It was being covered by this chap. And it was covered by a leather sheath, a long leather sheath, about 6-7 foot long. What do you call it? The very highly polished stuff. The shoes. It was polished leather, anyway. I caught this glint in the sun, and I unearthed it. And I looked out for booby traps as well, which was very, very keen on those days. And I got this out. And in it was the most beautiful main HQ artillery flag. And it was all gold silks. It was beautiful. The eagle at the top was solid gold in the staff itself. And the flag, I couldn't believe it was absolutely out of this world. And as a coincidence, some months after that, I got photographs to hand it through to me. And one was this particular flag being blessed by the Pope. Exactly the same flag. It was in Rome, in the Vatican. And it was exactly the same artillery flag. And of course I gave it up, and that's the end of that. But that was the first experience I had of doing an inventory.
Yes. What does that mean when you do an inventory in that situation?
You assess so many guns, so many people killed possibly, what vehicles were there, and any information, you know, maps, any maps in or intelligence that you could pick up there, and that was it.
It must be quite a gruesome job, was it, Dennis?
Well, you see, I tell you what it is, although I hadn't the terrible experience, not a lot of experience those days, it's like speaking a language. It's like speaking a language. You've got to think in the language to speak it. You can't think of literal translation. And I suppose it's like that. You think in terms of war and the association of war. And you accept it as part of that. It's a terrible thing, but this is what our brain is made up of, these sort of things. This is the reason we remember the good things, and our brain manages to forget the bad things in a lot of cases. And I suppose it became an acceptance very, very early on in days, because we used to go out on patrols quite a lot. We used to go out on reconnaissance patrols and fighting patrols and prisoners and what have you. And this sort of thing, it doesn't become old hat, don't get me wrong, but it becomes, the quicker you get into this thinking, the better it is for you. And you don't do it consciously, you do it subconsciously. It's the makeup of the human being, possibly. I don't know. It's like an automatic gearbox. It assesses the situation and accordingly gets in the right gear. And that's the analogy, the only analogy I can think of.
And I suppose really the training is part of that, isn't it? To get you into that...
Oh, absolutely. Well, you're not trained to that. That's the thing between that situation and you. And the realisation, the quicker you get over it, the better. Because you're on a razor's edge. You're not on any base jobs. You're there on the razor's edge the whole time. The whole time. And that is it. And
It's interesting you talking about the Italians in the desert and... the fact that there were very efficient groups, such as the artillery, and very good fighters.
Well, the artillery struck me as being very, very efficient and good, and for want of a better word, They're brave chaps, there's no two ways about it. But by the same rule, I felt that if we had an action in the afternoon, it was considered infradig, because that was siesta time. You see, and it wasn't on. It wasn't cricket. that's the sort of situation that I came about.